We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Welcome to Who's Counting? This is the podcast about all things elections, election integrity, how elections work, how the elections are supposed to work, how they sometimes don't work the way they're supposed to. And I'm Cleta Mitchell, and I am the senior legal fellow at the Conservative Partnership Institute, and I manage the Election Integrity Network, where we are doing our best to help citizens in America reclaim control over the election process. And today, I am very happy to introduce our guest, who is a friend of mine and who is a great patriot and who is leading the efforts in West Virginia, in the state of West Virginia, and really as a national leader on election integrity and making sure that elections work properly. And that is Secretary of State of West Virginia, Mac Warner. So, Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us. I'm so happy to see you today and I'm happy for you to be with us.
Cleta, thank you for inviting me on. I'm anxious to talk about these issues as it is really one of the leading issues across the nation. If we don't restore integrity and confidence in our elections, then we start to see the demise for democracy. So it's just the most important fundamental thing in front of us as a nation. And so I'm anxious to have this dialogue with you. So thanks for inviting me on.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Before we start talking about elections, I want you to tell our audience a little about yourself, and I want you particularly to talk about your service to our country and that of your children. So if you can start, tell us about where you're from and a little about your background and your service, and talk about your family.
Sure. I was born and raised in Charleston, West Virginia, one of six boys, actually. And so my mother was a saint to put up with all of us. We were raised, my father served in the Second World War, my grandfather in the First World War, on my mother's side, all the way back to the Revolutionary War. So we're a military family with a rich tradition. So as we grew up, both wanting to get that college education as well as serve in the military, a place like West Point seemed like the ideal place. So four of the six brothers actually did go to West Point, and then served in various capacities. A couple of us went to field artillery and another one infantry. And from the field artillery, two of us actually went into the JAG Corps. We came back here to West Virginia to get our law degrees. And then I got a master's degree at the University of Virginia in international law. And so I feel very fortunate and blessed to have had this opportunity both to serve in the military, get a great education, several different degrees, but then able to put that to use in a realm of international travel and actually intrigue. If you look at any of the hotspots that occurred between, say, 1980 and 2000, Haiti, Panama, Bosnia, all those places, in addition to other areas that you may not have known about, I was in the Ukraine, Peru, Paraguay, just a number of places that really opened my eyes to this big world of ours. And in many of these places, they are struggling themselves to create democracies, and they were having elections. And I'll fast forward. You mentioned my children. All four of my children, two boys and two girls, have served or are currently serving. In fact, one of them's deployed at the moment in the U.S. military. And one of them served in Afghanistan, was wounded there. Mm. And he said his toughest day after many, I can give you many harrowing stories, himself being wounded and the woman in front of him having her leg blown off, those kinds of stories. But he said the toughest day he had in Afghanistan was election day because of what the Taliban was doing with the IEDs and everything to keep people from voting. And when you hear stories like that, it really gives you an appreciation for what we have here in America and why it's so, it's delegate in one sense, and it's very, it has lasted the test of time of 245 years as us as a nation, but it really defines us, who we are, is that ability to go to the polls, vote for our leaders, and then a peaceful transfer of power, And that is who we are as Americans. It's our DNA. And it takes sometimes that travel to other parts of the world to have that appreciation. And that's why I'm so honored and thrilled to be able to come back to where I was born and raised and serve as the chief elections officer in the state of West Virginia, a state that in itself has its own intrigue of voter fraud and irregularities. By way of quick example, the 1960 election, John Kennedy in the Democratic primary, that election was fraudulent. It was bought by the Kennedys here in West Virginia. And that's what ousted Hubert Humphrey from the front runner position in the Democratic primary. And after he won West Virginia, Kennedy did. Then they went ahead with some more shenanigans in Chicago, a very famous fraud that occurred there that gave John Kennedy the presidency of the United States, probably in a very fraudulent way. And so I've been battling this my entire life since 1960. My family's a political family. We've been resisting this voter fraud in West Virginia. And now I think we're starting to get on top of it. We can talk about that, what we've done. But that's a little bit of the history, the family history, and why I'm so excited about the job that I currently hold and am enjoying it, even as we all struggle both in the state and nationally with voter integrity and voter confidence.
So when were you elected to your position?
I was elected in 2016. I was actually in Afghanistan myself from 2011 to 2015. And about this time of year, 6 years ago, I announced that I was going to come back to West Virginia. I was talking to the then candidate for governor on the Republican side. He said, yes, he would love to have me as the Secretary of State. So from Afghanistan, I announced my candidacy.
Oh, wow.
I left Afghanistan, like I said, about this time in 2015, 16. 16 was the election year. And so I came back and for 5 months campaigned for Secretary of State, won that primary in May of 2016, and then was elected to the office in November of 2016.
And reelected in 2020.
Then I'm reelected in 2020 by a much greater margin. Really, I think by that time we had restored what was broken between the Secretary of State's office and the county clerks, and we can talk about that. It had been broken up to that point. I had many of the county clerks, once I announced, reached out to me and said, here are the things you need to do to fix elections in West Virginia. And many of these were Democrats. This was a bipartisan situation, and that shows out here as we move on into the H.R. 1, H.R. 4 situation, the For the People's Act, or whatever they call it. 54 of the 55 county clerks in West Virginia, most of whom are Democrats, all unite behind and with me in opposing that legislation because they see the how it's filled with problems and is not good for voter confidence.
So talk to us about some of the things you said in your first term that the county clerk said to you needed to be done. And what are some of the things that you did in your first term? What are some of the major things that you say that you would say to other officials, election officials, you need to fix this. These are things you need to make sure you do or don't do. What are some of those things? Probably could take a whole hour talking about that, but give us what do you think are the top three things that you did or that you think have to be done?
Well, the first thing, very clear in our situation, was cleaning up the voter registration lists. And so that's what the clerks mainly came to me. They said the previous secretary was not enforcing the NCOA, the National Change of Address, where they clean up the voter rolls. And the time to do that is after the elections. And in fact, that's what the national law says, that every other year after the elections, you will clean those up. And she simply wasn't doing that. She wasn't working with the county clerks and providing them the data so they couldn't get their information out. So they are actually violating the law. They weren't doing their jobs.
So drill down a little bit on that. So this information, and does it work this way, the same way in every state, or is it different from state to state? Does the data come to the state and the state's supposed to give it to the locals, or how does that work?
Well,
and what's the information they're supposed to get?
Yeah, the states are different, but the law is the same that this is to take place every 2 years. This was part of the 1993 National Voter Registration Act, where they said, okay, DMVs are going to allow people to register to vote through the DMV process. But there was a second part of that. See, that's access, giving people easy access into the registration system. But there was a second part of that, and it's every 2 years you will clean those rolls up. You will take off the people who have moved, died, federal convictions, those sorts of things. And that's what was not being done in West Virginia. They were doing the first part. DMV was registering people. That's easy. But they weren't going back and doing the second half of that. And that's what has happened, my understanding, in a number of other states. And that's why you have some of these groups, I think appropriately so, shining a light on those states that say you have more registered voters in a county than you do have voters or eligible people, or because they don't clean those up. People die and they don't take the names off the list. Well, all that does is, one, it explodes those poll books. You have these thick poll books with a lot of names in there and people don't exist. But there's certain opportunities for fraud to exist. If you want to then fill out an absentee ballot in somebody else's name, you look at someone who's died, you fill it out, and so on. And so the first part of voter confidence is, I think, cleaning up those early registration lists. So I'll give you a number. Here in West Virginia, we had about 1.2 million registered voters. Since I've been in office, we have taken off 365,000 names. So you do the quick math, that's about one in four.
Wow.
You know, and so now we're down to about 1.1 million registered voters. Now, at the same time, we've registered about 255,000 new voters with, you know, the people that will fog a mirror if you hold a mirror in front of their face. They're breathing, they're alive. We know they're real, okay? Overall, we've had about 100,000 difference names that have come off. Think of that. In a small state like us, taking 365,000 names and not one complaint about it. This isn't purging rolls. This is getting rid of names, not people. Names off of list of people that no longer exist or live, or, you know, they've moved from West Virginia. In fact, West Virginia is one of those states that lost population between 2010 and 2020. We just lost a congressional seat over that. So think, that's a number of people that have left and they need to come off those voter registration lists. And so that's what we've done, working with the clerks. And again, I want people to know, I don't take one name off those lists. I simply provide this data to the county clerks and they remove those names. They're the ones who know the people, know the addresses, and whether they should be taken off or not. But the clerks have taken off 365,000 names. So that's the first thing. And then that starts to provide voter confidence with that the lists are properly maintained. A second thing that we've done with the legislature is we've enacted voter identification laws. And so ours is not necessarily one of the more stringent. It's not a photo required, but it is voter identification. So anything from a hunter's license to a driver's license to you name it, you can pretty much, I think there are about 18 different forms of voter identification that you can use.
Does it have to include the person's address that matches the address where they're registered?
Exactly. It does. So but if they've been voting there for 50 years and the poll workers know them, you don't have to have the ID. They say, yes, you're Joe Smith, and they'll let you vote. So it's I don't want to say it's a lenient law. It's there to provide integrity to the system. And so those are a couple of the things that I think are the most visible. And people, we haven't had any complaints from somebody saying, oh, you're now requiring ID you didn't used to. They expect it. They come in, most of them, with the voter ID out, ready to show it. They want integrity in the system. And so this has not been a problem in West Virginia.
Have you had any, you say you've had no complaints. Have you had any opportunity to run any analysis? You know, the thing that the left-wing groups always say is, well, if you have ID, it suppresses minority voting. Have you seen anything, any evidence of that since you've enacted voter ID in West Virginia?
No, that spin, it's a talking point that I like to throw out there, but it doesn't exist. Again, when you don't have any complaints, you know that there's not a problem.
That's right.
Exactly.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the top two things that you have just said, you've cleaned the voter rolls and you've required a voter ID. The Heritage Foundation has recently released an index of an evaluation of what are the criteria? First, what are 12 criteria that every election code should have? And then looked at the states to see if they how they measure up to what they ought to have in their election codes. And it's interesting because the top two. First two things that get weighted the most heavily are maintaining the voter rolls and voter ID. The very two things that you've done even before the Heritage Foundation published its report. So you're leading the way in doing what needs to be done. I know that you also were involved with in 2021, hoping to get some additional reforms in the West Virginia law. Talk a little bit about those.
Well, the one that is probably the most obvious, but you know, it gets cast as voter suppression because that's what the left loves to try to pin on folks, no matter what you're trying to do. And that is a recommendation from the United States Postal Service. Okay. The USPS itself sent out a form to everybody across the nation. I'll bet you got one that said they recommend 15 days. If you're on vote absentee or vote by mail, they recommend that you get this process done 15 days prior to give them plenty of time to get those ballots in to be counted by election day and so on. In the state of West Virginia, and this is obviously prior to COVID, in many states the same way, they have a lower number of days. So in West Virginia, 6 days. You can still request an absentee ballot up to 6 days prior to the election. But think about that. If you call your county clerk 6 days prior to the election and say, I want an absentee ballot, what are the chances they're going to be able to send you that ballot for it to arrive in your, you know, box, you pick it up, vote it, send it, put it back in the box and get it back.
It's not enough time. If you
had won the lottery, are you going to put your lottery ticket in the mail and send it and count on? No, you just don't trust that system. And when the U.S. Postal Service itself says we need 15 days to complete that those transactions. So I recommended to our legislature, we actually talked with the local, the United States is divided into postal districts and ours is run out of Pittsburgh. And we talked to the people in Pittsburgh and they said, actually, if you will do it 11 days in advance, then that'll be fine in this area. So we recommended to our legislature 11 days. But because of what had happened in Georgia, many people, many legislators across the United States got cold feet saying, well, we can't touch our election laws no matter what, how bad they are, where they might need to be fixed. And so the legislature didn't take it up. We're reintroducing it or asking them to look at it again this year. Hopefully they will take it up. But this is an example of where the left, with its constant barrage of spin and regardless of the facts, just like when they ran Major League Baseball All-Star game out of Atlanta, how much good did that do for the city of Atlanta? And how much good was accomplished in that? No, it was just all for show, but not touching the reality of the situation. So the reality in West Virginia is we would like to, based on what the clerks say and what the Postal Service says, let's move this these dates and get them adjusted to today's realities. Sometimes the legislatures are political beings as well. Respond
sometimes
to political realities.
Well, you know, I remember that I signed up to heard about the hearing at the last minute, and a couple of us signed up to testify by Zoom on the bill in support of the bill. And there were 41 witnesses at that hearing. Each of us had about 90 seconds, and there were 39. Leaders of left-wing organizations with chapters in West Virginia, and there were two of us. They were all opposing the bill, and we were, a couple of us were saying, no, this is a good change, you should do this. But it's so interesting to me but there's a massive, well-funded network of leftist groups who I say they're just trying to destroy every advance in election administration that has evolved over the last century. I mean, it used to be that the parties ran the elections, the government didn't run the elections, there was no secret ballot, ward bosses would go collect ballots to make sure people voted the way they wanted them to, and you got jobs or lost jobs based on who you voted for. They want to bring all that back, it seems to me. I don't get this. I don't get it.
Well, you do get it, Clayton. They're trying to make a situation where they can win the elections regardless of what the true voter intent is by things such as ballot harvesting, drop boxes, vote by mail, all those sorts of systems that are not as secure as voting in person on election day at a precinct under the watchful eye of trained poll workers from both parties. That's the gold standard recognized by people like Jimmy Carter and the Carter Center. They do this worldwide, and they've reported time and time again. That's the way you get secure elections that are that people have confidence in. And the more you move away from that, when you move away from an election day to an election week to an election month to early voting to vote by mail to absentee voting, all these sorts of things, that just opens it up. And since the left was able to get away with this in 2020 under the cover of COVID, they got away with it once. Now they want to nationalize that and make it required by all the states. And that just simply goes against our federal system of government. 50 states, 50 laboratories, 50 different ways of running elections. And even within the states, we have counties that actually run the elections or the townships. I think Wisconsin has like 1,800 different townships. Yes. We don't want to destroy that and nationalize and say you have to do it a certain way, and it's going to be the left's way with all access and no security component to it. And that's what you need in any of these situations. You want to balance the access component to the registration and the elections with a security component to make sure that that access is properly, has integrity to that system. That's where the voter ID comes in. In our situation, when you talk about ballot harvesting, you can only, in West Virginia, only bring back two ballots, and that's designed for a husband and wife type situation. But you can't go, like you said, the ward boss, go out and collect 100 ballots and bring them in, or even worse yet, drop it in an unmarked or a drop box, an unsupervised drop box. That's just asking for fraud, asking for problems to occur. So my suggestion is to get back as close as we can to an election day, and only if you have a valid excuse, a medical excuse or other, you're going to be out of town on election day. Those are the type things in West Virginia code. And I think we're one of 16 or 18 states that require a basis for an absentee ballot request. That's the security component that goes with the ease of voting remotely or in absentee or by mail. But then you have to have signatures, you should have signature verifications, address verifications, and other checks and balances in that system to make sure that it's not easy to just mass produce ballots and drop them in a drop box or whatever. So we've got a big issue, and they got away with it once. They want to nationalize it, and that's what HR 1, HR 4 were about, and why we need to continue to stand firm against it, no matter what form
I know. It's like a chameleon. It keeps changing, but it's still the same one. I want to make one comment. You know, you mentioned that there are a few states left who say you cannot vote by mail unless you have an excuse, a reason. You're going to be out of state, you're ill, and there are statutory reasons. I don't know how much you followed this, but the state of New York, the legislature in New York, put on the November ballot in 2021, proposed constitutional amendments that basically would change. Right now, the Constitution of New York said no same-day registration. The books for registration close, 30 days or some period of time before the election, and you can't vote by mail unless you have a particular reason. There's no such thing as no excuse absentee voting in New York. And so the legislature puts on the November ballot a referendum to amend the Constitution to get rid of both of those requirements and to allow a universal mail-in ballot and same-day registration. And the voters of New York said, nope, turned it down. I just think that's wonderful. So we're going to follow the voters of New York back to election integrity everywhere. And now we'll add West Virginia to that because you're one of the states that still follows that. And, you know, I think that Pennsylvania had a very good system requiring an excuse to vote by mail. And then the Republican legislature did away with that and opened the door for universal absentee voting. And then the Secretary of State, the Democrat Secretary of State, took that and ignored all of the, what you say, the safeguards, just did the access part. And I think Pennsylvania paid the price for that. The country paid the price for what Pennsylvania did.
Absolutely. And back to New York. That's not necessarily known as one of the most conservative states.
Exactly.
But you're absolutely right. Think of that. If you have same day registration and people coming in and registering on the day of the election and voting, then you're delaying those votes being counted until that verification takes place to ensure that they are 18 years old, they're a citizen, they live at that address and so on. And so now we start getting back into that election season where votes are being counted over a period of time rather than on election day. So that's one of the major problems of voter same-day registration and the automatic voter registration. Several of these things that the clerks in West Virginia are not fond of and have advised me that it's not a good idea, especially trying to nationalize that. And then jumping to Pennsylvania, you've got that situation where their state law said the ballots had to be in by closing the polls on election day, but the Secretary of State made a call that says we're going to accept them for three more days. And the Supreme Court, liberal Supreme Court, went along with that. Who gets to make these calls? The codes say that this is the legislature's job. It's not an election official. It's my job to execute those laws. It's not my job to make those laws up and adjust them as I see fit and so on. So I think that would be one of the messages we should all take out of today's conversation is we need to strictly enforce the laws that are on the books. And if you don't like those laws, then go to the legislative process and talk about that, debate it in open, transparent format so people can understand the rationale for changing the law. But once that law's in place, you shouldn't change it in the middle of the game. That's moving the goalpost or moving the goal line during an election. And that's what provides the impetus for a January 6th or other frustrations when courts won't hear the cases, the laws have been, or the rules have been changed in the middle of the game. That does not provide confidence in the system. And right now we need to move towards confidence, not towards more irregularities and ambiguities.
Well, you, I could not agree with you more. And you've referenced a couple of times. I want you to talk a little bit about you testified before the United States Senate hearing about H.R. 1, the Senate version being S-1. Talk a little bit about what that is and what you said and what you think about what's going on with all that.
Well, I'm glad you asked that. Again, H.R. 1 or H.R. 4, it's a number of different times because it's come up three or four times. It keeps getting shot down. But this was that attempt to take everything that they got away with in 2020. Georgia would change it one way. Pennsylvania would change it another. Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona. Each of these states had their own situations where they changed the rules of the game. That's what caused all this uncertainty about the election. Mm-hmm. And now these H.R. 1, H.R. 4, are attempts to take all of those changes and make them into a national directive from Congress that says, here's how you will run your election. And by the way, we've seen a similar sort of effort to talk about audits because they didn't like Michigan or Arizona doing their own audits. They want to try to nationalize how you do an audit. And again, as we talked about, we have at least 50 different ways we run elections and even thousands of ways when you get into the different counties and the different voting machines and rules and so forth. We need to leave this where the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution and the state's Constitution say this is a legislative responsibility.
State legislators.
State legislatures. Mm-hmm. They are the ones who make the rules. They're the ones who ought to tell us how to do the audits based on their specific situation. We don't need to nationalize this. And that's what this effort was, H.R. 1 and so on. So when I went to testify, I've had a number of people say, well, were you nervous or worried about testifying in front of the Senate? It was very easy for me. I said, no, I'm just telling them what the 54 of our 55 county clerks told me before the election, during the election, after the election. We're still united saying, leave us alone. We've got this. I don't need Washington, D.C. bureaucrats, Chuck Schumer, and Nancy Pelosi telling me how to run an election in Logan County, West Virginia. We've got this. I'm cleaning it up as Secretary of State. The people are very pleased with the role that the office has done in cleaning that up. By the way, we've gone from 2 investigators statewide to 10 investigators statewide. We've just come out with a see something, text something new app that if it enables every voter in West Virginia to basically be an arm or an extension of our investigative unit.
Oh, that's
unit. Fabulous. So you see something, you take a picture, not inside the poll booth, but outside if somebody's campaigning illegally or intimidating, you take a video of it. Text it to us, and we get the investigator on the scene to take care of it. So people know that we're serious about fraud. I've worked with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the local attorneys, and we are serious about fraud in West Virginia. This is the sort of thing that provides stability and integrity to the process, and the voters come away with confidence that we are doing things properly in West Virginia. If you look at the MIT report that came out after the 2020 election, we're in the top 10, at least, maybe the top 5, with voter confidence. This is both Republicans and Democrats, voter confidence in West Virginia in the way we ran these elections. And I intend to do the same thing next year.
Well, you know, that is so interesting because when you think about, I'm just kind of thinking about what you're doing, what I mentioned about what the Heritage Foundation top priorities are. And then I think about what are the top things they want to get that they want to prohibit in HR 1, S 1, HR 4, all of that. And I'm thinking what you did was clean the voter rolls, require voter ID. That's what the Heritage Foundation said are the top two things that need to be done to ensure integrity. What are the things that HR 1 would do? Prohibit states from having voter ID and prohibit states from cleaning voter rolls. So it's just, we can see what they're trying to do, but it's pretty interesting when you think about the juxtaposition of what the progressive left and the Democrats in Congress want to do versus what the citizens want. They support overwhelmingly both of those things. And you've shown doing those things in West Virginia has increased public confidence and will encourage people to vote.
And then let's just continue the list. And it's same day registration.
Oh, that's right.
Registration.
All the things that we don't want.
Vote by mail, drop boxes, ballot harvesting. I mean, it just goes on. All of those things were in those bills.
Yeah.
And now we get back to Senator Manchin, and he objected to a couple of those, but not many. Like he liked the voter ID. And so now we have these massive ads here in the state of West Virginia from outside the state, money coming in saying what a great job Senator Manchin's doing because he came up with a compromise. Well, that compromise was just a repackaging of the other bill. And so
who's saying that? I mean, well, some left wing group, no doubt.
I can get you the names, but every day, if you listen to our statewide talk show, Hoppy Kirchable, the ads run constantly. It's mind numbing, talking about what a great job. Now they've moved on. In addition to the election integrity bills, they've now moved to the infrastructure bills and trying to apply pressure in that regard as well. So the good thing is that Senator Manchin has maintained his opposition to busting the filibuster. And as long as he stays firm on that, then I don't think they're going to get to the 60 votes they need either for the voting legislation or for the infrastructure, but we'll see. They got the first part of that infrastructure bill passed. So we also have to stay vigilant and stay aware of these efforts. And many people talk about the Russian misinformation. This is misinformation right here inside the United States by billionaires. And we haven't even touched on the Zuckerbucks yet. I mean, there are large companies. There are millionaires and billionaires trying to impact the outcome of these elections. What I would say in an unfair way, they're skirting around the campaign finance laws. And so we're starting to see states push back against things like the Zuckerbucks thing. County officials and local officials cannot accept, solicit, or use outside money. This is the role of the state to have fair elections. This is the role of people like me that are elected and answerable to the electorate to run clean elections. This shouldn't be like a NASCAR race where this is election is sponsored by Facebook or whatever.
That is a very good analogy. The 2020 election brought to you by Facebook.
Exactly. You know how that's going to favor. And then they try to hide behind, well, we just gave it to a impartial, well, bogus. The impartial group hands it out. And if 6 or 7 out of 10 of the people that they're pushing towards the poll happen to be progressive or liberal, they're going to do that. Then they have that cover. Well, we did give money out to the Republicans as well, or the conservatives. Well,
a little tiny bit.
You just play the numbers and you see where it goes. Yeah, you got it.
Well, you know, you spoke about this. And I think you made a really good point about the audits. And I know that you've really stood up to some of the pressures that are on these national groups, pressures by like the National Association of Secretaries of State and the National Organization, I don't know what the exact name of it is, of election administrators. Talk to us about that. Explain to people what those are. My observation is that they've really been pushed left over the last decades, and that oftentimes they are pushing policies supposedly on a nonpartisan basis, but which are really the partisan views of the progressive left. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I think that the results are determinative here. We've already had Tennessee has stepped away. Now I understand Missouri is stepping away from that organization. That's unfortunate, but I understand on a principled basis, those secretaries made their choices to move away from an organization they felt that wasn't worth the dues that they were paying, that then if the organization went in a certain direction.
Well, talk about what is the organization you're talking about.
Well, the National Association of Secretaries of State, and then the National Association of Elections Directors. And so they are parallel, but like in my situation, I'm the chief elections officer as the Secretary of State, but my elections director would belong to the elections director conference or whatever.
Okay.
And those are the ones that you're saying. And when we get to the audits, this is the most recent situation, the one where I stood out. I voted against this nationalization. They were trying to, what it was a reaction to Michigan and primarily Arizona. They didn't like those states saying, we're going to go back, and they've called it a forensic audit. We'll talk about that if you want, but a thorough audit of the process. Well, if the state legislature authorizes that, as we talked earlier, that's their prerogative. That's their job. And so the way Arizona runs an audit is and should be different than the way Pennsylvania runs its audit or West Virginia runs our audit. We know our system. We should be in that situation to advise the legislature as to how an audit should be run. So this was an effort basically saying, I think they were just trying to slap, you know, these states because they were looking for fraud or irregularities that are going to occur or that occurred. And I think that's the appropriate role of those legislatures in those states. There's a reason why the national law says you will keep ballots for 22 months. Why would you keep a ballot for 22 months if it weren't for the reasons of an audit or reexamining? So here's the second main thing that I'd like your listeners to take out of this interview. And that is the focus has been entirely wrong on recounts and audits. The focus needs to be on how did these votes get into the system in the first place?
I agree 100%. Hear, hear.
So how did somebody get on the registration list? Was it properly done? How did they cast that ballot? How was that ballot handled until it was counted? How was it tabulated? That is the process matters in the law. The law is a process. That's why you have Miranda rights and so on. Irrespective of whether the person did it or not, they have a right to legal counsel. They have a right to remain silent. You can't torture them and that sort of thing. The process by which you get to the outcome matters. And nobody to date, I've been to CISA, that's the Center for Internet and Security Agency, you know, the EAC, the Elections Assistance Commission, NAS, nobody is looking at how the ballots got into the process. So you go back to Pennsylvania situation. If they were coming in 3 days after the statutory deadline, that is a process problem that needs to be looked at. Their Supreme Court should have addressed that and adequately explained why it was appropriate here, but it's not appropriate next time, or it will be appropriate next time. Those sorts of things. Our U.S. Supreme Court should have looked at that Texas case with 17 states that joined into it to say, is this appropriate that what happens in another state does affect me in the state of Texas or in West Virginia when Michigan or Pennsylvania or Arizona counts ballots that shouldn't have? In a presidential election, exactly. And so the process matters. And so the same thing on the recount, and I make the analogy to a football game. Once those points go on the board, if the referee calls a touchdown for a pass that was caught clearly outside of the end zone, should not have counted. But if the ref calls it, and let's say we're talking a high school football game where you don't have replays and everything, those points go on the board. So now, no matter how many times you recount those points on the board, you're going to come out with the same result.
Yeah, that's right.
But the issue is, did that official in the striped uniform make the right call? Did the officials in 2020's election in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, Georgia, did they make the right calls? And if not, that's what we need to be talking about. And that's what the legislature in Georgia tried to talk about and then got slammed because then they moved the Major League All-Star Game out and so forth as a way to pressure them to keep from talking about it, to keep from passing laws. And I told you earlier, that impacted us in West Virginia. Our legislature was afraid to talk about it because of what happened in Georgia. And in other places, this has occurred as well. We all need now calmly go back, do what Alabama, I just saw something today where Alabama is looking at getting rid of the sucker box. You can't accept this is a proposed bill in Alabama. And I think this has been passed in some other states.
It has been this year after people saw that horrendous situation.
Yeah. So this is how it should be done, is on a state-by-state basis, go back and see what is applicable in your state, what laws need to be enacted to clean up after this COVID election of 2020 to restore confidence and integrity in the system. We need to be having a dialogue, and that's why this interview right here is so important, is to help get that word out. And to reemphasize, the issue is not the points on the board. It's not the votes that Biden had or Trump had. It's how did those votes get into the system in the first place? And if you have ballots, absentee ballots that aren't creased, if you have ballots that are pre-printed, we need to go back and look at that and say, did that happen? If it did, by God, we got to clean it up. If it didn't happen, we need to report that accurately as well, so people on the right
point. That's right? A good point. Well, you know, I read something recently, which I'm sure you're aware of. The Public Interest Legal Foundation sued the state of Maine because the state of Maine would not allow the organization, which is it's an election integrity law firm, to have access to the voter rolls in Maine. And they sued the state of Maine, and part of what they did was to FOIA and get discovery, and found that an official in the Secretary of State's office in Maine was part of a network of leftist organizations across the country that had targeted you because you had the temerity to go to Washington and testify at the U.S. Senate against S1 and this, as we've talked about, the Senate version of HR1 that would do all these dastardly things that we're not for. And so talk a little bit about were you aware of that? And have you had any fallout? Have you felt the pressure from those left-wing groups coming after you? Tell us what you want to tell us about that.
Well, I'll start with the PILF. When I came into office, 4 counties in West Virginia had been identified as having more registered voters than they did actual people or actual voters. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you this, they are doing good work, because that sort of thing, I can tell you, I was able to use that with those county clerks and say, if you don't clean this up, this lawsuit's coming, and you're going to be testifying to somebody as to what you did, what you didn't do, what you were supposed to do, and that sort of thing. And it helped get on with the process of getting rid of 365,000 names. And so now we have no counties that have more registered voters than we do eligible voters, and so on. So what they're doing in all the states is a wonderful, it needs to be done to keep the pressure on. There's nothing like sunlight as a disinfectant to clean up.
You're talking about the Public Interest Legal Foundation, what they're doing, going after the voter rolls.
Right. And so that's an appropriate thing for them to be doing. With regards to the coming after me personally, I understood that effort was out there. Some people brought that to my attention. I understood there was an effort in Maine, that there was somebody that was doing that. We've had other situations in Michigan that are inappropriate, but we are addressing that appropriately. I'm not concerned personally. A few years ago, the Secretary of State, now Senator from California, put me on a target list with four other secretaries of state to try to get us not elected in 2020. Sometimes that almost works to your favor. When you have a liberal from California against you, you're probably doing something right. And so if they want to take shots at me from Michigan or Maine or wherever, have at it. I know I'm doing the right thing in the right way. I've got the backing of the county clerks. And if they don't like cleanup, or clean elections, that's the people in their states are going to have to deal with that. I know that the testimony that I gave in front of Congress was spot on with regards to what's right here in West Virginia, and I think what's right nationally with regards to providing integrity to the process.
Well, I can't let you go without talking about our favorite person from West Virginia, who keeps us all up at night, and that is Senator Joe Manchin. And I'm sure you get this everywhere, which is tell what gives with Joe Manchin. I mean, he says, I'll just give this example. You made reference to it, but he gave his list of principles that he wanted to see in any election reform bill. These are the things I, Joe Manchin, will support. And so the Democrats come back and they issue their new H.R. 4, and it has none of the things that he said he wanted, and he puts his name on the bill. What is with this guy? I mean, he says one thing, and then you read all these articles about how he's negotiating. What gives with Joe Manchin?
Well, I'll begin by saying, actually, Senator Manchin and I and my family, we're personal friends. It's a small state. Everybody knows everyone.
Right.
Senator Manchin was a pallbearer in my oldest brother's funeral, to give you just a feel for that. So on a personal level, Senator Manchin is a very engaging guy. There's always that standard when you want to go have a beer. Yeah, that's the kind of guy you want to go have a beer with. But that's not to say that you trust him when it comes to all things political. Senator Manchin and I see eye to eye on a number of things, but we don't see eye to eye on some others. And this election integrity is one of those where he has said one thing and then done the other. So even with the initial bill, H.R. 1, he spoke out against it. But when the time came, he voted for it. Okay, now, there weren't enough votes to overcome the filibuster and so forth. So it went down, and he knew that, but he still went with his majority. Think about this. When everybody talks about, you know, Senator Manchin, you know, having the swing position and so forth, he's the one, by being and remaining a Democrat, gives us a Chuck Schumer in charge and control of the U.S. Senate. If he didn't like that, he could easily switch or go independent and caucus the other way. So he's not that savior. But so far, he has held the line, like we talked earlier, on the filibuster. And so people in West Virginia respect that at least he's paying attention to things such as energy here in West Virginia. He's interested in maintaining the role that Senator Byrd carved out with regards to the Constitution and the role of the filibuster. He has sworn that he will not upend that. He is sitting in Senator Byrd's seat. We all know Senator Byrd carrying the Constitution in his pocket. So as long as Senator Manchin maintains that position, then at least what that does is it enables a check and balance in that Senate process, and it doesn't make the Senate like the U.S. House of Representatives, where just one vote can swing the entire vote on the issue. In the Senate, if the Republicans want to put up a opposition and have a chance to debate something, then they can maintain that filibuster, which requires 60 votes. Now, there have been talks about ways to massage that, and I think Senator Manchin has entertained that. That's what we need to watch and make sure he doesn't slide into one of these situations that allows this very slimmest of margins, only because of the Vice President of the United States gets to cast a deciding vote in a 50-50 split. That is the slimmest of margin you could ever imagine. But all of a sudden, think that they've got a mandate after a very hotly contested election in 2020. This is not the time to make sweeping reforms and change our entire democracy, the way we get to the polls, the way we register, the way we count votes and so on, simply to try to give them an edge in 2022 or 2024. And that's where I'm hoping that Senator Manchin maintains his position on the filibuster. But with regards to the rest of it, I think you identified, we really can't count on where he is with regards to the nuances of an H.R. 1, H.R. 4, and all the intricacies that go into the packaging of that bill. And that's where my concern is. And that's where these ads in West Virginia are so misleading. They talk about the one thing that he supported, the voter ID, as if that, and then they're going to sweep all this stuff underneath, you know, the rug and pass it. We really have to stay vigilant and make sure that that doesn't happen.
Well, and it is, he's a wily fox. I have to say that. And, you know, I wish that he would just be as upfront as Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, who says, you know, you get 60 votes for a bill and I'll vote with it. And she puts her name on it, but you don't have to worry that she's going south. A lot of people have talked to her, a lot of effort, but with him, it's just sort of like every day is a new day and every day he's in the Senate, I'm worried. I just want to say, Mr. Secretary, you are a true American hero. You're a true patriot. I think it's so interesting that you said that you announced for Secretary of State while you were still serving in Afghanistan. And I think that says to me that you understand in your heart of hearts, you understand how fundamental the election system is to the preservation of our republic, as Dr. Benjamin Franklin said to the woman leaving the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. It's a republic if you can keep it. And thank you for what you're doing to help us keep this republic. We thank you for all you're doing. And anytime you want to come and talk to my audience about elections, election integrity, you are always welcome. We thank you for all you do.
Thank you, Clete. It's been a joy being with you today.
Thank you. And thanks to all of our listeners. You've been listening to Who's Counting with Clete Mitchell. It's our podcast about election integrity and all things elections. And we hope you'll share it. We hope you'll subscribe. Come to our website, www.whoscounting.us. And we say a hearty goodbye and join us for another episode next week. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Clete.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, become part of the Election Integrity Network.